Yeah, so we should move on to, so thanks a lot again, Torben. And now we should move on to Jan. Jan, where is Jan?
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, you're here, good, okay. So Jan, can you share your slides?
Yes, of course. Here we go. Oh, sure. Okay, can you see this?
Yes, yeah, we can see it. So, okay, so Jan is going to talk to us about Wasserstein-Ganz theory and applications of deep generative models. Please.
Yes, so hello everyone. Yes, as Hansa just introduced, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my research on Wasserstein-Ganz. So first, let's start with what Wasserstein-Ganz are and why anyone cares about them. So they are an example of GANs, which are kinds of models which look at a lot of samples from a certain probability distribution. And then based on this, they are trying to be able to create more samples, generate more samples, which follow the same probability distribution that as the data they have been trained on. So here you can see a couple of very impressive examples of state-of-the-art GANs. So none of these pictures are real objects. These are synthetic images that were generated by a GAN that looked at a lot of human faces, for example. And okay, so these are very nice images, but then you may wonder, how does it relate to COVID then? Well, so one example that I would give of an application that I would give from a personal experience is that we are having this collaboration where we are trying to create a rapid response to COVID in the form of providing AI tools that would be helpful in tackling COVID. And we had many ideas of algorithms that we could start prototyping. And the data was already there in the hospitals, but we were unable to start working because of all the privacy and ethics considerations, which takes weeks to resolve. And we were unable to start prototyping. If the hospital could train a generative model based on the patient's data, then they could create a synthetic data, which would follow exactly the same distribution, would have all the same statistical properties, but would not give away any confidential information. And they could send it to us and we could start prototype models based on that data. That unfortunately didn't happen. Okay, and now I want to talk a little bit more on like what about the theory of these models and my research on them. So something I was investigating is the discrepancy between the theory of these algorithms that was originally suggested and how they work in practice. So the conventional story, so these models, they consist of two neural networks. One is the generator, which generates the images, and the other one is called discriminator, which is trying to provide the generator with a feedback of how close the sample it generates currently are to the samples from the distribution it is trying to learn. So does it follow the distribution it's supposed to follow or not? And basically, this discriminator is trying to provide this feedback by estimating something called Wasserstein 1 distance. So the Wasserstein distance is a distance between probability distributions. In this case, it would be, you can think of mu as the distribution that the samples generated by the generator follow right now, and mu is maybe some target distribution that you're trying to learn. So to compute this Wasserstein distance, you're trying to maximize this functional over the class of one Lipschitz functions. And how you do this in practice is you replace this F with this discriminator network, and you're trying to maximize this quantity using some kind of gradient ascent algorithm. And so that was the theory, at least, of why we thought they work originally. But then when you look into the details, it turns out that, well, first thing, that it's not so simple. It's much more complicated. So reality doesn't follow this assumptions, let's say. So first of all, you can examine how close do you get to this supremum. So you're training some neural network, and now the question is, okay, how close were we to the supremum you're trying to get? And it turns out you are not being close at all. So in practice, these algorithms are orders of magnitude apart from this supremum. And therefore, you can say that it's some kind of Wasserstein-inspired loss, but it's certainly not computing the Wasserstein distance. So the second question you might ask is, okay, so we failed to get the supremum, but maybe we can do some more clever optimization. Maybe we can somehow fix this, and maybe we can get to the maybe we can get this approximation correctly. And something I would like to argue is that you shouldn't even try. that basically Wasserstein distance is a bad idea as a loss function for a high dimensional generative model. And so one problem that you can immediately, that you will immediately encounter is the sample complexity. So it's well known that Wasserstein distance suffers from the curse of dimensionality. And you, as you can see in this functional, you have two expectations, but these expectations cannot be, of course, computed analytically. They have to be estimated based on some finite samples. And in high dimensions, the number of samples you need to get the accurate estimation makes it completely unfeasible. Another problem is that the estimates that you get based on these finite samples, both of the Wasserstein distance and its gradient, are biased. And therefore, when you're trying to optimize it with any kind of SGD, stochastic gradient descent based algorithm, you will encounter very serious problems. And stochastic descent is the only game in town when you're dealing with such a large, with large data sets. Another problem, even if you would forget about all the above, is that for when you're dealing with image data, then this Wasserstein distance, it implicitly relies on L2 pixel by pixel comparison of images, which is very bad metric to use. And finally, there is an interesting connection which tells you, so, okay, this equation may look a little bit scary, but I will explain what it means. Basically, it tells you that if you are trying to minimize the Wasserstein distance from certain measure row over all measures which have support equal to K, then the minimizer of this is a measure that is concentrated on centroids of the K means. So you might be here now wondering, okay, but why are you restricting the support to K? How is it relevant? And hopefully that will, so here is an interesting experiment that hopefully makes that clear. So suppose that we want to use, this Wasserstein distance as our loss function. And suppose that we want to learn how to, the probability distribution of human faces. So here is a batch of 64 human faces. And now I want to, now I want to learn something that generates human faces like this. And now we consider three candidate outputs of a generator, and we will decide which one is the best based on Wasserstein distance. And in this case, I'm assuming that I can actually calculate this supremum accurately. And so first batch, as you can see, is another batch of real human faces, another 64 human faces. And we calculate the Wasserstein distance between this batch and this batch of human faces. And it turns out to be something like 48. So already notice that this is a relic of working with finite samples, because the Wasserstein distance between a distribution and itself is zero, but the Wasserstein between a sample from a distribution and another sample from the same distribution can be very different from zero. Second output is just 64 times repeated a face, which is a pixel-wise average of all faces in the data set. And when we compare this with the batch of faces that we want to get, then it turns out that this is already better according to Wasserstein distance. This output is preferable. And finally, the last sample is k-means centroids with k being equal to 64, so equal to the number of elements in your batch. And this is, according to Wasserstein distance, much closer to this than the original face, than other batch of real faces. So Wasserstein distance would prompt you to generate something that looks like 64 k-means centroids, which is not what you want from your generative model. Okay, so hopefully, that is what I wanted to say about the theory of Wasserstein GANs. But I also thought that it will be interesting to talk a little bit more about their applications. So other application is something that I'm also working on in this COVID collaboration I mentioned before, which is data imputation. And so as also Thomas mentioned before, very often in clinical practice, you are trying to train your models on missing data, and the implementations are not well suited to work with them. So what you do is you're trying to fill in the blanks with your best guess before before training your classifier, let's say. And how you can think about filling in the blanks is you can think that you want to preserve the distribution of the whole data. So to fill in the blank, you want to sample from the distribution of the unknown features conditioned on the features that you know. And this can be achieved by training a generative models that learn these conditional distributions. And in fact, GANs have been applied to this problem, and we are trying, and we are comparing and evaluating different approaches. And then we are examining how this imputation then affects the downstream classification tasks. And okay, so this is, I see that my time is running out. So this is all I would like to say today. And if you find these questions about Wasserstein-Ganz interesting, then I encourage you to read the paper Wasserstein-Ganz work because they fail to approximate the Wasserstein distance. And that's a little bit of shameless advertisement at the end. Thank you very much. And bye-bye. So, I mean, sorry, if you have any questions, I would be very happy to answer.
Thanks a lot, Jan. Yeah, and please keep your slides. I mean, if people want to.
Of course. Let me go back here.
So, are there questions for Jan about Wasserstein-Ganz?
I think Alberto has his hand up, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, go ahead, Alberto.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Thanks, Dan, for the great presentation. So, you motivated this via privacy. Basically, which is great. It's a great use of this. And I was just wondering, from a very high level, how does this compare to more traditional data privacy strategies? One thing that comes to mind is that in more traditional data privacy strategies, what you do is you have a certain statistic in mind that you wish to sort of preserve. And so therefore, probably, because that's like a summary of the data, then probably it's going to be cheaper to do that strategy than trying to replicate the whole distribution of the data. So this is the kind of question, you know, I'm asking you, you know, at a high level, how do they compare maybe in terms of cost or in any other terms?
So I have to say that I'm not an expert on privacy as such. I'm more working on the GANs per se. But I would imagine that GANs, what they give you is they are trying to learn the whole distribution, not one statistical property of the distribution, right? So they would probably be more computationally expensive and more data hungry, but they give you basically the everything there is to know about the distribution if they converge with their training correctly. Because the goal, the holy grail, is to have a model which generates samples that exactly follow the distribution that you started with. And then you can recalculate any statistics from the samples that you generate. And now you can generate as many samples as you want from this model once trained. Does that make sense? I hope I understood the question correctly.
Yep. Yeah. It was just in case you had a few more insights, but I understand you're looking into WGANs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Jan, you have a question on the Q&A. I don't know if you want to answer it live. I mean, if you have a quick answer, or otherwise. So it says, which of the problems occur with regularized Wasserstein distances, e.g., entropy regularization? Can you see this one?
Yes. Sorry, I just had a. So in terms of entropic regularization, entropy does help with the sample complexity issue. It does alleviate the sample complexity issue, but basically all other issues still stand. And we also have run experiments, and it has been also explored by other people, what happens with entropy regularization. And it also leads to this kind of blurry images if you get for an accurate approximation of it. But that might be also a huge part in this, might be this L2 distance that is underlying everything. So certain combination of like entropic regularization and changing the underlying metric to something more perceptually based, that could lead potentially to something that works. But the question is whether you want to operate in this divergence minimization framework, or whether you want to understand what these guns were doing in the first place, because they were not approximating Wasserstein distance, but they were working. So the question is, what were they doing before we tried to get this supremum right? So that's one direction you can go. And the other direction you can go is try to get the supremum right, but fix these issues. So change L2, change sample complexity by regularizing with entropy. And that's certainly a path worth exploring.
Okay, good. So thanks, Jan. I think so. We are okay. So we're a bit behind on time. So let's. Thanks again, Jan. And so we'll move on to Derek now.
Thank you.